on my pillow that won't dry. On the road beyond my years, I've no sorrow, but today I don't walk alone. Step by step, day by day, day by day, I'm on the run to recovery, trusting God along the way, trusting God along the way, trusting God all the way.
How's everybody doing tonight? Good. Ready to have a meeting?
Yes.
All right. Welcome to the Fort Lauderdale Primary Purpose Big Book Study Group's Thursday Night Alcoholics and God Speaker Step Series. Before we get it kicked off, Ryan's going to do a joke for us.
I am Ryan, I'm alcoholic.
Are we juggling?
All right, stop me if you heard it. All right, so a cop's driving behind a car and it's swerving a little bit, so he decides to pull... He decides to pull the guy over. And when he gets up to the driver's window, he sees the priest inside. He says, "Evening, Father. Have you been drinking tonight?" The priest is like, "No, not at all, sir." And the cop's like, "Well, do you mind telling me what's in that bottle on the passenger seat?" And the priest says, "Oh, that's just water, young man." So then the cop, not believing him, says, "Well, pass me the bottle." So he smells it, and he pours some out, and it's wine. He says, "Do you mind explaining this, Father?" And the priest says, "Jesus, he did it again."
I'm a recovered alcoholic. My name is Jeff. Thanks for joining us tonight. In a minute, we're going to start our two-minute meditation. So please take a moment to get situated. Please turn off all devices that make noise or that might or will distract others. Take this time to get connected to God. Let the craziness of the day drift away and ask God to help you stay focused on the step study tonight. And when we turn down the lights, we'll get started. Say the fog light prayer. If you don't know it, you can follow along here or repeat after me. God, let your love shine through me like a fog light. so those who are lost, sick, and dying can find your love through me. There is a solution from the Big Book, page 17. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. I've asked Shannon to read Appendix 2, Spiritual Experience. We read this because the main purpose of the 12 steps is to have one, so it's kind of important to know what one is.
Shannon, alcoholic?
Hey.
The term spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which upon careful reading shows that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms. Yet it is true that our first printing gave many readers the impression that these personality changes or religious experiences must be in the nature of sudden and spectacular upheavals. Happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. In the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described. Though it was not our intention to create such an impression, many alcoholics have nevertheless concluded that in order to recover, they must acquire an immediate and overwhelming God consciousness, followed at once by a vast change in feeling and outlook. Among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Most of our experiences are what the psychologist William James calls the educational variety, because these develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often, friends of the newcomer are aware of the difference long before he is himself. He finally realizes that he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life, that such a change could hardly have been brought about by himself alone. What often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. With few exceptions, our members find that they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource which they presently identify with their own conception of a power greater than themselves. Most of us think this awareness of a power greater than ourselves is the essence of spiritual experience. Our more religious members call it God consciousness. We wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation.
Please refrain from disturbing others by talking or constantly getting up and sitting back down. This is a tech-free meeting, so set your phones to airplane or meeting mode or just turn them off. So we have Allie tonight. I only met her a few moments ago, and what I've gathered is that she's from Del Rey. She thinks she might have been on TV once, and she's down to touch her hair a lot tonight. Okay, so that's what I know. But also what I know is God's probably going to take this time to use her and speak through her. And if everybody would help me, welcome her to the podium.
Hi, my name's Allie. I'm an alcoholic. It's so good to be here tonight. Thank you to the group for having me. Anytime Alcoholics Anonymous asks me to do anything, the answer is always yes, and that's how I was taught. And it used to be a have to, and now it truly is a get to. I'm going to tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And in my big book, in the basic text for my life, it says that I'm going to kind of guide you as to how I came to establish my relationship with a power greater than myself, because that's what the first 100 men and women did. And that's what the personal stories are all about in the back of the big book. I'm really grateful to be here. I wasn't always somebody who showed up for life. As a matter of fact, I was the opposite. I was somebody who hid from life. And I was one of those hopeless cases of the hopeless variety. I was like Bill Wilson. And I really identify with his story. And, you know, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, for me, is written as a template for how it is that I'm supposed to work with a new woman when I'm taking her through the steps. You know, I have the doctor's opinion, which for the first time I get the definition of the alcoholic. Thank God for Dr. Silkworth, who wasn't one of us. And then I have Bill's story, and I identify with his hopelessness and his egomania and his bottoms and what it takes for him to truly surrender. You know, that was me. I was a relapser. And then I have a solution in chapter 2, and in chapter 3 I learn more about my disease and my relapse and how I'm not weak-willed or immoral or mentally defective, but I'm somebody who needs God, and I need God fast. And then in the 4th chapter I have, you know, we agnostics, which in the beginning, my first sobriety, I didn't think I needed that chapter because I had it all figured out, and I thought, well, that doesn't apply to me. I was raised Jewish, not practicing Jewish, and actually most of the people in my family were atheists, but I just figured, you know, I'm Jewish. I don't need the God thing. But that didn't even make sense because I grew up kind of misinformed with the whole God thing. But that's why good sponsorship is so important, because my sponsor lovingly said to me, you do need this. You do need this chapter. And I come to find out through my teachers, and I've had amazing teachers along the way and amazing sponsorship and amazing group of women who have just lifted me up from the beginning, and thank God for them. And they said, you know, this is one of the most spiritual things you'll ever read. And I was like, what are they talking about? I don't even, you know, in the beginning, I didn't even like the way the big book was written. I was like, this is terrible, poorly written. And I, you know, with my ego, I was like, I'm just going to rewrite the whole thing, which doesn't work. I tried doing that in rehab. It didn't work. I relapsed. Self-knowledge, yeah. Roland Hazard, didn't work. And then chapter 5, you know, those first 4 chapters plus the forwards plus the doctor's opinion are getting me to come to some conclusion so that I can get ready to get on this journey, and I'm going to be rocketed into a 4th dimension of which I never even dreamed. And Bill does it so suddenly in his story. You know, he's in trouble, and he's hitting all these bottoms, and he's stealing from Lois, and he can't even cross the street, and quicksand is stretching all around him in all directions, and he woke up. This has to be stopped. He saw that he's through. He can not so much as take one drink, and then he drinks again. So it's like, what happens between that? What happens between swearing off with or without a solemn oath? What happens between that moment and me putting the very stuff in my body that I know is killing me? Well, that's what the second step is for. That's the insanity. So let me back up a little bit. I'm getting really carried. I like talking about the solution. I'm not one to talk about the problem because we all have our stories. But our stories are important. And when I'm sitting down with a newcomer, I tell a little bit about my story so that she could see that I drank the way she did. You know, just like Bill tells us his story, so that we can identify with that information and say, yes, maybe I am an alcoholic, maybe I'm suffering, maybe I do have this thing. You know, that's why our stories disclose in a general way. It doesn't say, you know, I'm not going to stand up here and do an hour of a drunkalogue. I'm just going to be general about it. What I used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. And how I came to establish this relationship with a power greater than myself that's going to solve not just the drink problem, but all my problems. Because we stopped talking about alcohol after page 45. So I'm the only alcoholic in my family. That I know of, but people in my family could use the program. I mean, couldn't everybody? They have isms, but not like me. And I moved around a lot growing up. I was always the new girl. I switched schools between the ages of kindergarten and my senior year 17 times. Started out in California, went to Jersey, went to Vermont, went to New York, went to Philadelphia, went to Tennessee, went back to Jersey, and then finally down to Florida. And, you know, there was a lot of confusion and all of that. And I just remember, you know, Bill gives us these adjectives. He says that we're restless, irritable, and discontented. And unless I can experience an entire psychic change, there's little hope for my recovery. Well, I had that deal going on way before I picked up a drink. You know, I was restless, I was irritable, and I hated people. You know, I'm just going to add a few in there because before I had the solution, those 3 adjectives seldom suffice to actually describe me. I was way worse than that. I hated people. I didn't know that the hatred was actually fear. I just used that as my armor. Because I was always new. You know, I was always the new girl in school. So I was like, I'm going to hurt you before you hurt me. And I had a very bad temper. And I was a big tomboy. And I used to wear super baggy clothes. And I was in sports. And, you know, I tried to play all these roles to kind of keep myself separate at a safe distance from the rest of the world. And I didn't know how to have a relationship with anybody when I got here, least of all myself. I didn't even know who I was. But my ego told me I knew who I am. You know, my ego's like, yeah, you know who you are. You're better than these people. You don't need AA. But I really didn't know who I was. I was a shell of a person. And I just remember crawling out of my skin and feeling like, you know, I'm going to kill somebody. And I was like 9 years old when I'm thinking these things. Not normal for a 9-year-old. You know, I see 9-year-olds today, and I'm like, they don't have that deal going on. Like, there was something different about me. And I really just felt like I was born in the wrong time period. You know, I felt like I was this crazy misunderstood artist or like whatever, great philosopher. And I, you know, Bill says, you know, he has these intellectual heroes. I had those too. And I needed something. I needed a solution to that because I was not doing too well without something that provided a sense of ease and comfort. So I had my, and I'm a blackout drinker, so the details are fuzzy, but I remember having my first drink, and I didn't get drunk, but I got real buzzed, and I felt like for the first time, I felt some relief, and I felt that finally the shakiness in my body was a little bit quieter, and all of a sudden I could be part of this thing called the human race, and I could talk to people, and I finally had a reprieve from the rest of the world. And then I did other things for a while, but what happened with me was, you know, people were just pissing me off left and right. And I get to high school and I can't deal. I can't go on in this world. Like there's something bodily and mentally wrong with me, even before I drink. And when I start using alcohol, when I start drinking, it evens the playing field for me. You know, I finally have all that madness in my brain start to calm down just enough. My heart, which was this cavernous hole, finally starts to fill up a little bit. And I'm able to go to high school and have an excuse as to why I don't fit in this world. And I start to have this best friend called alcohol. And I turn to it for everything. You know, it becomes my absolute everything in life. And I managed to procure one friend. She was like my running buddy. And she could drink like I did. You know, she was another tomboy. And we were like these two badass girls that, like, you know, in our minds, we, like, ruled the world. She lived on a farm, on a horse farm in New Jersey. And she drove a truck. She had her farmer's permit. We were, like, 15 years old, 16 years old at the time. And she kept getting into car accidents, but it was never because of the alcohol. You know, it was never because of that. And I remember, like, we'd be hanging out, and then I'd be like, hey, you want to hang out tonight? She's like, no, I broke my leg. And no, I did this. No, I did that. And then I started falling down the stairs because I was living in my grandmother's basement. And I started getting bruises all over myself, and I started getting, you know, consequences. And I never thought there was anything wrong with that. I just figured if you were like me and you were feeling the way I was feeling, you would drink like me too. And it got really, really bad for me. My disease progressed. I was unable to get out of bed unless I had a bottle of pop-off vodka within arm's length. And I didn't want to drink it cold, and I didn't want to mix it down. And I started getting sick. You know, Bill talks about getting super sick from drinking, and that was me. I started getting sick, so I figured I'll mix it with milk. And then, you know, I had to hide it from everybody, so I started putting Hershey's syrup in it to make people think I was drinking chocolate milk. I'm like 17 years old. Like, why is this girl drinking chocolate milk 24 hours a day? It doesn't make sense. But whatever. You know, it was working for me. And, yeah, I was drinking my vodka and chocolate milk, like, all throughout the day. And, you know, my biggest goal in life was I never want to be sober. Like, me and my friends, we all thought, my so-called friends, my running buddies, the people that I took hostage, I'll say, you know, we always said, let's just go out and party because we're not going to live past 30 anyway. Like, that was our thing. And I was, like, I was in the smart classes in school, which is still strange to me because I stopped showing up for school, like, my junior year of high school. And they weren't going to let me graduate because I started missing so many days. But my mom went in and, you know, kind of tried to fix that situation. Said, you know, you have to let her graduate. She has, you know, straight A's and she brings a lot to the table. And, you know, she tried to, like, make a case for me. So, yeah. But it was really, really bad. And any kind of relationships that I managed to secure in that time, I wound up losing because people couldn't be around me. I was disgusting. I'm like what the book says. You know, I was disgustingly antisocial. And when I drank, I'd be the life of the party for like 5 minutes. And then somewhere I would cross that invisible line and I was Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I would just snap. And I wound up getting in fights and I wound up catching some charges out there. And, you know, like I said, I had a bad temper. I had a bad temper before drinking. And then with alcohol, it just got worse. You know, and I think I saw a man at one time be this alcoholic who, like, you know, was able to become a safe person, meaning that nobody ever hurt him because he had such a bad temper when he drank. He, like, would, you know, throw furniture and punch holes in walls. And somehow my sick brain started emulating that. Like, I thought, if I could just be like this man who's this crazy alcoholic, then nobody will ever hurt me. And so that's what I became. And so, you know, the time came to go to college and I couldn't do it because I wanted to figure things out and like go travel, even though I didn't have any money. I was like, I'm going to go travel. I want to go to Europe and I want to like write a book or whatever, whatever I was telling myself at the time. And my mom was like, whatever. Cause I was working the whole time. Like I didn't steal too much. I did steal a little bit, but I didn't steal like too much from, I always had money to get my alcohol. And so, you know, I went to college, it was on full scholarship, and I couldn't go to class, and I was still antisocial and, like, hated being around people. I was a real loner, and I loved my alone time. You know, I was like Ernest Hemingway or something, or Edgar Allan Poe. I would, like, sit out there drinking straight from a bag, like a bottle of, like, JD or, like, a bottle of Jack Daniels. I'd be sitting under a tree on campus with, like, normal 20-year-olds, like, running around playing volleyball and soccer and, like, in sororities and stuff, and I'd be sitting there drinking out of a bag, like, writing like this tortured soul, and they would just stare at me, and people, and the dean was like, you have to go to class to keep your scholarship. And I was like, screw you, like, you don't know how lucky you are that I'm even at your school. Like, do you know who I am? And like, that's how I felt. Like, I totally felt that way, and it was ridiculous because I had never contributed anything positive in the world of anything philosophical except in my own head. But that's that ego. You know, Bill says I set off to, you know, overtake Walter Hagen, which is like the Tiger Woods of our day. That was me. I was like, oh, you know, I'm going to be like this great thinker, this great philosopher, hippie chick that listens to hip hop, whatever. And I got it all figured out. And that, you know, I was totally confused, total identity crisis. But, and that's how I was. So they kicked me out of school and I started waiting tables in Atlantic City. And because this was all in New Jersey, and that's where I really hit bottom pretty. And I went back to that school again. They let me back in, but then I got kicked out again. And this is just how it went for me. And it started getting bad. You know, I started winding up in psych wards and put on psych meds, and people thought that I was suicidal because of the way I was drinking. And then it got to the point where my mom, because like I would always wind up going back to my grandmother's house, and like they wouldn't let me in the house if I had alcohol on me because I was so violent when I drank, and I would steal their car, and I would steal their meds, and I would steal their credit cards. And so I would have to hide my alcohol in a pile of leaves outside of the house so they would like frisk me and then let me in, and then I would sneak out to get my booze and then sneak back down into the basement and drink all night, and like that's just how I lived. And then it, you know, it came to the time she was like, if you don't stop drinking, you have to leave. And I chose booze. So I went and I was homeless. And I was homeless under the boardwalk in Atlantic City, and that was a dark time for me. By choice. You know, my family would have let me back in, but alcohol was my master, and I chose that. And so, you know, I had terrible bottoms out there, and waiting tables in Atlantic City with, you know, having the money, and then my busboy was like a guy that could get stuff for me, and it was just not a good scene. And I was homeless, and then I was in psych wards, and, you know, all the bottoms. You would think that that would make me stop. Like, you would think that that would be enough to where I would be like, obviously alcohol is a problem, but that didn't make me stop. But this is where God comes in. So, like, I'm going along, and I'm doing my thing, and I go to this psych ward, and it was, like, it's really scary. Like, it was, like, a real psych ward. It was, like, a state-run psych ward, and the people in there were actually crazy. Like, I was, like, fake crazy. I was really more alcoholic insanity kind of crazy, but they were, like, crazy, crazy. Like, Jesus Christ. Like, I think I'm Jesus Christ, and I'm running around, and I'm talking to, you know, whatever. Crazy. And I actually felt comfort in that. I was, like, these people, I could maybe be friends with these people, but no. I felt more comforted in the psych ward than I did in society, which was telling you a lot about my mental state at the time. I was like, but anyway, so there was this lady who used to bring meetings in, and I didn't have any money and I didn't have like any insurance, and they owned 4 beds at this state run rehab in New Jersey, and it was called Maryville Rehab. And, they kind of got wind of the fact that she, like, I don't know, she was like an angel. She just saw me, and she said, you know, I think maybe this diagnosis might not be accurate. Like, maybe you have a problem with alcohol and drugs. And I was like, okay, whatever. I wanted out of that place because it was scary. Like, it was not a good place to be in. There was violence and abuse, and it was bad. Plus, I couldn't smoke cigarettes, and I was a smoker at the time, so I couldn't smoke cigarettes. And it was like being in a state-run prison. Like, the food was terrible. And so you could smoke in the rehab. So I was just selling this lady a bill of goods. I was like, whatever, I'll do whatever it takes as long as I can smoke a Newport, you know. And so, you know, off I go to the rehab, and I get this big book, and I still have it today. It's not this one, because this one, well, this one's kind of falling apart. But the one I keep in my house is, like, big time falling apart. So I don't take it out of my house. It's sacred to me. and I still have it. And this guy used to come, these people, H and I used to come in and bring meetings in. Now, this rehab isn't like the rehabs that I see down here. You know, we were on lockdown. Like, we weren't allowed to leave. You could go outside to smoke a cigarette 3 times a day. The food was a little bit better. And, like, they start talking about the steps. I see the steps on the walls the first time I've ever really seen them and given them any thought. And I'm sitting outside one morning. They used to wake us up at 6 a.m., which I'm like, why are they waking us up? We're not allowed to go anywhere. Like, why don't you just let us sleep? Most of us are detoxing. Like, seriously, what is the hurry, people? Like, I just had such a bad attitude. I was so rebellious, and I had such a bad attitude. And my thing was, I always know better than you. Like, you guys always are wrong, and I'm always right, and you should just do things my way. I was the same. Here I am in a rehab at the age of 24, and I know best. I know what's going on, you know. But somehow I didn't get kicked out of there. I mean, I tried to follow the rules. And I memorized the book. I tried to memorize the book because I wanted to prove to everybody that, like, I knew everything, even though I didn't really believe it in my heart. And that's how I always was in my whole life. Like, my whole life, I was like that. Very much like, let me look good on the outside and act like this smart cookie, but inside I'm dying. And so I memorized the steps, and I did the first three alone, not with a sponsor. I don't recommend that. And I was sitting outside one day, and I used to journal every morning. And, like, the sun, you know, I was abstinent because I was in the psych ward. It's all fuzzy, but I think I was in there for, like, 3 months. So I had, this was the most, because I never drew a sober breath. From 20 to 25, those are my forgotten years. And Bill says I hardly drew a sober breath in that time. You know, that was me. Like, I didn't draw a sober breath at all in those 5 years. I don't remember much of that time. Even in the psych ward, I'm clearing out. You know, I'm in the fog. And, so I had, you know, I had some time to kind of, for my brain to kind of dry out and the neurons to start firing again just enough. And God got in there a little bit, and I was looking at the way the sun was, and it was 6 in the morning, and I was looking at the way the sun was coming through the trees, and I got this feeling like he was with me and everything was going to be okay. And I had never known a God like that before. Like, I knew an idea of God, but really the whole time I'm growing up and I think I'm praying to God, but I don't think he has any, I don't think he is really in my heart. I just think he's somewhere like a cosmic thing, like that's out there. Nothing that I need to turn my life over to. I'm just like, you know, I'm going to keep running the show. I did have an idea, but really the whole time I was just praying to a God that I imagine, I envision. It's coming from my mind where the disease is. So really I'm praying to myself, which not recommended. That's why we're the 11th step, by the way. But that's, you know, it tells us in the 11th step, careful when you do that. but yeah, so anyway, I had that experience and it gave me hope. Like, for the first time I had hope. And I had self-knowledge, you know, and we have this alcoholic Roland Hazard who gets knowledge of self. You know, he's the reason that we have the spiritual solution. He goes and he gets treated by Dr. Jung, and Dr. Jung gives us the spiritual solution, gives us the, you know, whole definition of a psychic change. Old attitudes, ideas, and beliefs have to be cast aside. And then, you know, we get set up with a whole new set of ideas. That's Dr. Jung. That's because Roland Hazard, this guy, goes to Vienna because he had all this money, so he had the money to do it. And he gets the spirit solution and brings it back. And that's why we have, you know, the spiritual part. Well, it's part of the reason why we have the spiritual part of the program. But I relate to Roland because I'm like, yeah, I have knowledge of self. Like, yes, I understand some of this stuff. And I understand some of the things in the book. But I'm not buying in all the way, you know. And this began, you know, Bill says, thus began my last debacle. Like, this began my last debacle. That was the seed. You know, this is where God starts to come in. But I'm still not ready. I'm not ready to give up the way I think it is. So I, you know, I get out of the rehab. I relapse, big, you know, just like Roland. I relapse. I don't stay sober. And I actually wind up moving in with my boyfriend, who I met in the psych ward. We were, like, going to get married. Like, that was love at first sight. And it got really bad because he was a supplier of other things, and then he wound up getting locked up. It was just unmanageable. He wound up getting locked up, and I tried to, like, take over his business, but his family came up from Georgia, and they're like, you're not getting anywhere near the business. And I was like, I'm fine. And I had been up for, like, 3 weeks straight, and they were like, you're crazy. Crazy white girl. What are you doing? So, yeah, it was bad. But I met this kid in rehab, another boyfriend. So, yeah, wasn't very, you know, whatever. Another boyfriend that I met, he was detoxing from heroin, and I was, like, in love with him. I was like, look how hot he is. Like, he looks like he belongs on the cover of, like, Rolling Stone. He had, like, these nice forearms. Rest of him is just skin and bones. But he had, like, these nice forearms, like, this gorgeous model face because it was, like, all sunken in. And, like, this was my type back then. And so, and I swear, I was like, this guy, like, I know about the other guy in the psych ward, but this guy, he's it. Like, he is for, you know, he was younger than me, and he, like, understood that I was, like, this tortured soul, and, like, You know, I met him when he was still shaken from the heroin, and it was like love at first sight. But the reason I say that is because, you know, God uses people. Like, he put people strategically in my, just like the whole book, just like the whole program. The reason why we sit here 80 years after the book is written is the miracle of this program. It's things that are beyond my comprehension that start happening in my life. So this guy comes in, and, you know, I'm living in a roach-infested motel room. The other boyfriend got locked up, and I'm not drawing a sober breath. Like, I'm wasted every day. I can't get up out of bed without my alcohol. And, like, he called me on the phone. The other guy, the heroin soulmate, called me on the phone. And he was down in Florida. He was living in what came to be the male counterpart to the halfway house that I went to, Boca House. I went to Awakenings. Yay. Shout out to Awakenings. But so he was down here. And, you know, Bill says when he meets Ebby, who's kind of like his sponsor, it's the guy that carries the message to Bill, you know, and you get the italics writing. He says he was sober. And, like, Ebby sits face to face with Bill, which is kind of like how we convince a newcomer. You know, we make a demonstration, the light shines through us, whatever. You know, newcomers can see that we have something. And Bill saw that with Ebby. And I heard it with this kid. I heard it with the boyfriend, even though it was audible, it was on the phone. Keep in mind, I met this kid when he was detoxing from heroin, so I could tell he had dried out and he was sober just from his voice. And he's like, you got to come down here. I was like, where, to Florida? I was like, I'm not coming to Florida. Like, it's where old people go. Like, I'm not going there. And he's like, it's so awesome down here. I have a cell phone. He had like a Metro PCS or whatever. And like, we didn't have anything. And he was like, cigarettes are cheaper. And I'm sober. And AA is awesome down here. And I was like, I just wanted to come down here to see him again. So I called my mom, and this is, like, God knew that I wasn't going to come down on my own volition. So he puts the, you know, love of my life or whatever in my life or whatever. And so I call my mom, and I finally get honest with her. I don't tell her everything I'm doing, but I was like, Mom, I think I'm an alcoholic. She's like, what do you want to do about it? I was like, well, there's this halfway house in Boca that I think might be able to help me. And keep in mind, they're not going to let me back home. So I'm basically homeless. Like, I don't have rent at this efficiency that I'm living in with the cockroaches and all the other... and the other boyfriend's family is coming for me because I did some other stuff. And, like, you know, things are starting to happen. Life is looking really bleak for me. And so it was the last house on the block. So my grandmother, because we don't have any money at the time. And my grandmother winds up, and this is a woman that I tortured for, you know, I lived in her house and I did hellish things, you know, in her house. And she puts up the money for me to come down here. And that was a God thing for me. Like, this is a woman that I stole from, that I was abusive to, that I completely disappointed. And yet she paid for me to come down here. And so I come down here and I go to the halfway house and, like, AA is just so different down here. Like, I'd been to a meeting or two up north because of something else, but AA was different down here. And you know, in my halfway house, they're like, you have to get a sponsor, and we're going to take you to meetings, and you have to do the steps, and, like, all this stuff. And, like, I went to my first meeting, and I walk into the room, and it was like Alcoholics Anonymous was, like, on steroids. Like, it was crazy. Like, everybody was, like, so happy, and they could like, tell I was new. I was like, how do they know I'm new? And I go in, and, like, you know, one of my favorite speakers talks about the recuperative powers of the alcoholic ego. You know, my ego had started to come back because I had some time dry. And so right away when I go in, I'm not letting you guys in because I'm like, I'm cool. I don't really need to be here. Like, the ego came right back, you know. But there was a different part of me that God kind of started working on. And there was a different part of me that started kind of waking up saying, like, I do want what you guys have. I just don't know how to step from bridge to shore. I don't know quite how to get there. So I get this sponsor and I start doing the steps and I do it 100% because I figure I'm going to be a good student. I'm going to impress everybody. I want to sound good in meetings. And so we start doing the steps, but I have this thing called the great obsession that comes back. And in the third step, or in the third chapter, in More About Alcoholism, it says the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. I'm the abnormal one. I think I'm the normal one at the time, but I'm the abnormal one. The great obsession of every abnormal drinker is that one day I'm going to be able to control and enjoy my alcohol. So I proved to myself that I can control it. I took my big book to the bar down the street from the halfway house, and I opened up to chapter 3, and it was like, you know, if you don't think you're one of us, try to drink and stop abruptly. I'm like, all right, bartender, let me get 20-ounce Stella. I'm going to drink it. I'm going to stop abruptly. I'm like, okay, so that, a check, I did that. And, you know, try it more than once. I ordered another one. And I'm, like, following the directions, and there's just people. This is the rehab capital of the world. So there's people in the bar that are probably like, wow, look at her. Like, she's really insane. Like, she's sitting here with a big book drinking, trying to prove to herself she's not an alcoholic. And, like, literally, this is happening. And here's the thing, and this is why I tell this story, is because I feel like this is kind of true for a lot of us. Like, we learn that we have an allergy to alcohol, but we also have an obsession of the mind. And my allergy at the time, it's a progressive disease, might not have been, like, I was able to drink those two beers and leave, but I wasn't able to enjoy it. So the wording is so key in the big book. It says, to control and enjoy my drinking. I could control it briefly, but the next day I was thinking about it. That deal was running me all day. When can I get back to drink again? And now I'm walking around with a lie, and my heart is killing me. Like, I feel like I'm going to, like, kill myself. Like, it's bad. And you would think that that would be enough for me to surrender, and it wasn't. Because I've got a really big fear problem when I get here, and that's what's blocking me from my higher power, is this fear, which we learn in the fourth step. But anyway, this went on for 3 years. I would get some time, I would get 6 months, I would get a year. You know, I knew the book, I was following around big book thumpers, I was, like, sponsoring, but my heart isn't in it. Like, I'm still thinking that one day I'm going to be able to go to Italy and drink some wine and, like, talk about art, and it's going to be okay. And I'd never surrendered. I was able to do steps 2 through 12, but I didn't have the first step. And they say, you know, the first step is the only one you could do perfectly. I couldn't admit that I'm powerless. I could admit there was some moments where I might have been powerless. Now, here's what's so key, and this is when I finally realized, like, it finally hit me. I got to such a low place spiritually. I didn't lose a lot on my relapses down here. It wasn't anything like that physically. But having had, I don't even know if this is possible, but having had a taste of the God thing and seeing you guys and seeing how awesome AA is and still putting the poison in my body after and then lying about it. You know, I would get up and pick up medallions and I didn't have that time. I was stealing time from the rooms of AA and not telling the stuff to my sponsor in my fifth step and knowing that's all about integrity and I can't even do that right. And it's like, you know, that was a hellish place for me. And it got to the point on my last relapse, I only drank a little bit, but I couldn't look at myself in the mirror. Like, I wanted to kill myself. And that's, like, very ego deflating for me because I come from a family where, like, that's not a thing. But I wanted to kill myself. I couldn't take who I'd become. And so I was drinking a Natty Ice on the beach in Del Rey saying the third step prayer, which Natty Ice is, like, really cheap beer, but it's kind of strong, so it could do the job. Natural Ice. I say Natty Ice because I'm from Jersey. But yeah, that doesn't work. I'm doing a third step prayer, drinking beer, and I'm, like, asking God to, like, take my thoughts and my actions, but I'm, like, drinking. And, like, I spent, like, 4 days trying to figure it out. I was at the jumping off place. I was at the fork in the road. You know, Bill talks about it a lot in the book, and, you know, he went through stuff like that, too. So I'm, like, okay, maybe I do need to be here. And so my prayer goes, and this is where he just comes in and does for me what I can't do for myself. You know, I'm sitting and I'm meditating one morning, and I'm asking God for help. And my prayer goes from, dear God, please don't make me get honest, to, dear God, please help me get honest. And the help, that part wasn't from me. You know, I know today that that came from a loving higher power. It had nothing to do. I was never going to ask God for help like that. And it was help from my heart. It was a whisper from my heart. It was sincere. You know, and in the third step, it says, it doesn't matter the wording as long as we make the effort and our heart is in it, as long as it's a heartful, soulful consent, as long as our heart is in it. You know, the wording doesn't matter. And that right there, it shifted me. I had goosebumps. Like, I felt, you know, Bill, you know, I didn't have the sudden and profound change like Bill has, but I knew there was a bigger thing happening. And I just surrendered. I said, I can't do this anymore. And so then I asked God to put the right woman in my life who could help me get over this whole disconnect that I had. And so she did. And it was a woman I knew from my home group for a while. But I didn't want what I wanted what she had, but, like, she scared me. I was like, wow, she's, like, really sober. Like, she's a woman of grace, and she's got double digits, which maybe she didn't at the time. She did. Yeah, she did. And I was like, you know, I was judging her. I knew I was going to ask her to sponsor me because God, like, kind of kicked in there. And it was one of those things where we're standing, you know, there's, like, this whole spiritual thing about being in the hallway, like, God says yes, no, or maybe, and, like, when a door shuts, another one opens, and if you're not getting the open door, you stay in the hallway. I was literally in the hallway outside of my home group, and I knew that the way I had been doing it hadn't been working, and I asked God that day to, you know, put a sober woman in my life who could, like, get me closer to him and, like, get me fixed, like, free me of this bondage of self kind of thing. And I see her in the hallway, and she's, like, talking to another lady, and I'm, like, judging her. I'm, like, there's no way this is going to work. And I'm, like, having this conversation with myself as I'm walking up to, like, talk to her. And so the head's saying, no, don't ask her, don't ask her, don't ask her, don't ask her. And then as soon as I get up to her, I'm like, hey. And I just picked up a white sheep at my home group. And I was like, hey, so I was thinking, like, maybe, so I have a sponsor. But I was thinking maybe you could, like, take me through the steps but not sponsor me. Like, what is that? I don't even know what that was. I was so scared to, like, even talk to her because I thought she was so awesome. But I was like, whatever. It's like asking somebody out on a date, which I never did. But if I did, I imagine it would be that scary. And so she's like, no, that's not a thing. Like, I'm not going to do that. I was like, well, how about you just, like, advise me spiritually? And I, like, keep my other sponsor. And she's like, try again. I was like, will you sponsor me? And she's like, God, I thought you'd never ask. So I was like, okay. She's like, but under one condition, you have to, because I was a big fan of running away and, like, not leaving my side of the street clean. And she knew that because I had that same home group for 3 years. And so she watched me pick up white chips and vomit all over the place on the meetings all the time about, you know, whatever. So she knew a little bit about how I was. And so she told me, she's like, I'll sponsor you, but you have to go back and fix things with your old sponsor. You need to come clean with her and tell her that you drank. You need to, you know, get honest with her about how you lied to her in her home on your fist step. And you need to tell her that you love her and you appreciate everything you've done for her, but you've decided to go in a different direction. And I'm not sponsoring you until you do that. And it felt like the gates of hell had clanged on my heart. I was like, what an order. Like, what are you talking? I can't do that. I can't go through with that. Like, I did not have enough self-esteem in my pinky to even imagine that I could ever have a conversation that scary with another human. Because keep in mind, I don't know how to talk to anybody when I get here. Like, I'm completely broken. I've always hated people. I've broken relationships, you know. I'm page 52. I'm the bedevilments all the way. And so I was like, there's no way I can do this. And so I just prayed and I asked God for help with that. And I learned that you can ask God for help with pretty much everything, you know, as long as your motives are good. And so I asked for help and I did that. And then her and I started working together. And that was almost 8 years ago. My sobriety date is October 20th of 2009. So I'm coming up on my anniversary. And it was crazy. Like she was loving, but she was also like super strict. So I never knew which part of her I was going to get. I was like, you know, some things I was trying to test the waters with a little bit. And I would get like tough sponsor. And then other things I was like feeling like crap about myself and like really in a dark place. And I would get like loving sponsor. And like I learned how to have relationships with other people, healthy relationships, because of the relationship that she taught me to have with her. And through that, you know, for the first step, we read it out of the 12. Because she knew that I knew the book. So she's like, we'll read it in the big book. She's like, because there's different places in the first four chapters where you can find that first step. And then it is letter A. In the big book, A, that we were alcoholic and couldn't manage our own lives is the first step. But then, you know, she had me do some other, like, emotional sobriety things, too, because she's like, there's a disconnect. Like, there's a reason why you keep relapsing, and we're going to get down to it. And I was like, okay. And I just did whatever she said. Like, I completely surrendered. I, you know, after that prayer that day, God just, like, took over, and I just did whatever she said. And so in the first step, I finally admitted that I was powerless and I couldn't manage my life. And it wasn't the unmanageability before I drank, or after I drank. It was before I drank. Like, the fact that my mind is going to tell me, after all the evidence of my past, the fact that I almost died, like, 30 times, I was flatlined, you know, all the crap that we go through, and I still keep drinking when I get down here, thinking I can control it, that's insane. So, and that's unmanageable. So I kind of saw that, and I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense to me. And then in the second step, you know, it doesn't say that I believe right away. It says I'm going to come to believe. So, you know, we admitted is an action word. And notice the first word of the first step is we, which was huge for me because I'm a loner. I don't like people. I didn't start really liking people until around step six. You know, I'm still like, eh. But that's where the transformation takes place. So I guess it took what it took for me, whatever. I wasn't homicidal anymore, so that's good. But yeah, we admitted is an action word. And it means, you know, I'm going to do this together. I'm going to hold, you know, a sponsee. I'm going to hold a sponsor's hand. We're going to say the Lord's Prayer. And I hated, like, group things, you know. I think I've said it, like, 10 times. But, yeah, I really did not like doing stuff that other people did. But I'm dying. I'm willing to do whatever it takes. I don't want to die from this thing. And I know I'm going to die. I know that's my bottom, is death. So I just did whatever, you know, she said. And she was a busy lady. And in order for me to be sponsored by her, I had to do the things she did. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. I had to literally follow her path. Like, she was working full time. She had like 30 sponsees. She's like, we're going to meet every third Friday of the month at Panera. And I was like, okay. And she's like, you know, and these are the meetings I go to. If you want to talk to me, show up at the meetings. And I was like, okay. She's like, these are the times I can talk to you. Okay. And these, you know, this is what we're going to do is you're going to start reaching out to other women. And you're going to call those women because you're not always going to get a hold of me. You know, and another great speaker always says, my job is to get you as independent of me as quickly as possible. Like, you got to start relying on God, you know, which we start kind of maybe starting to do in the second step. Now, I had been through the steps before the relapse, but I hadn't been through them with my heart. So I kind of knew it, but not. And so came to believe means that I don't have to believe right away, but it's like in the fourth chapter. You know, I start to kind of see that God is concerned with us when we want him enough. And that God is either everything or he's nothing. What's my choice to be? Alcoholic death, insanity, jails, institutions, death, or spiritual principles. You know, that's all part of that second step. And so that gets me ready to take the third step. And for me, it's just a decision, but it's a crucial decision. And I have to be convinced. And Bill says it after the ABCs in the big book. A, that we're alcoholic and can't manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power can relieve us of our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought. It's the second part of the second step. And then it says being convinced. Being convinced of what? A, B, and C. See, my deal was I wasn't convinced all that time, but I'm finally convinced. And I start seeking God with the desperation of a drowning woman because I know I'm dying. And you know, the dark thoughts would come back and the dark night of soul and like all this crap. And I just started turning to this higher power, and it's earnestly sought, you know, fearlessly sought. It starts talking about it in chapter 4. Fearlessly searching, searching and fearless. You know, Bill uses these words because he's letting me know the biggest thing blocking me from this higher power is my own fear. Selfishness and self-centeredness, which is really my own fear. And so I have to ask God to remove that fear. Help me believe in you. You know, I started saying all kinds of prayers because I didn't want to feel like crap anymore. So we make a decision. And then in 4, you know, I make this searching and fearless moral inventory of myself. And I have 5 columns in which I do that. And I have a good sponsor that walks me through how to do that. And I start learning that I can commence to outgrow fear. It's one of the promises of the 4th step. But it takes what it takes for me. You know, it's all my fault in the first 2 columns. In the 3rd column, I'm kind of seeing, oh my God, my instincts are running me like a crazy person. I don't react sanely and normally to life. Like, every time I have an interaction with you, something is getting affected, and then I'm taking my will back, and I'm back on page 62 and 63 again running the show, you know. And then in the 3rd step promises, it says, when I take a position, when I sincerely take a position, what position is this? Is that I am not and God is, you know, humbly ask of myself, I'm nothing. That's the position Bill's talking about. That's the position I have to take. But sometimes I have to take my will back and get into enough pain before I'm ready to take that position. So it's like the 3rd step dance kind of thing. But humbly take, you know, this position, all sorts of remarkable things follow. We have a new employer, being all powerful, you know, God's, and it tells me this before I even do the work in the big book. Like, the work doesn't begin to the 4th step, but it tells me in the 3rd step that God is going to be my employer in all my affairs. So that doesn't mean when I come in, I have to get a job right away. That doesn't mean when I come in, I have to have a roof over my head. I can be sober, homeless, right, if I'm taking that position. Because he's everything. My money is his. My love life is his. My job, his. What's my only goal is to get through the steps and try to help his kids. That's it. That's the only thing I have to worry about, especially if you're in your first year. And I did, like, I believed that, and it worked for me. You know, and I would go to work. I was waitressing at in Boca, which was fun, sober. Yeah. And that 4th step, then there's the 4th step prayer, which I love, on page 67, which I used a lot in the beginning, which is magical. It's a magical prayer. I don't believe any of the words should be changed in that prayer. I've changed them in other prayers because, you know, I'm like neurotic, but that prayer is super special. You know, God, this is spiritual. You know, I would wait on tables and they'd be so rude and nasty, and I would go in the bathroom in the handicap stall, which probably wasn't too spiritual if there was a handicapped person that walked in, whatever. I'd say, God, please help me with this table. Like, this is a spiritually sick person. How can I be of service to this person? God, save me from being angry. Thy will be done. And then I'd go out and I'd, like, wait on the people, and, like, they wouldn't complain to a manager. But, like, the thing is that I have a very telling face. So, you know, there was, like, the reason why they're complaining, I had a part in that. So I had to do a mini 4th step on it. Like, you know, what's the resentment? What are my instincts? So the first 3 columns are, it's still all your fault. And then in the 4th column, that's where the shift happens. And self-pity gets removed because I was a victim in the 4th step. It's all your fault. But then in that 4th column, well, what do I do to set the ball rolling? What? I don't do anything. What are you talking about? It's all, you know, everybody else. Have you not been listening to me, sponsor? Yes, I've been listening to you. What have you done to set the ball rolling? Oh, okay, so that's different. And then the fifth column, well, what's effect, you know, where, what are my character defects? Which this is where I get the list for step six. Selfish, dishonest, resentful, fearful, inconsiderate. Check, 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 check. It's all of those. Like, spoiler alert, it's all of those for every resentment. except for dishonesty. That one came and went. But usually it's all of those. And so then in the fifth step, I humbly share it with her, and that's a spiritual deal. And, you know, one of the greatest honors today is hearing fifth steps. And, you know, and then in six, the transformation happens. And in seven, the transformation. In six, I'm getting ready for seven. Seven, the transformation happens. Eight, I'm getting ready for nine. Nine, another transformation happens. And the amends are, you know, Bill starts talking about prayer and meditation in the ninth step. You know, each morning we ask for kindliness, patience, tolerance, and love, right? He gives us that prayer for the ninth step. Because why? Because ninth step, it can be a scary step if you don't have a guide, if you don't have a good guide guiding you. And I have to take God with me for all that. I have to send him. I had scary amends to make, some of them. So I had to believe that he could and would if he were sought. And I would send him ahead of me. Like, God, please bless this person, whatever. You know, let this out. And I'm not in charge of the results. I learned that in the third step. I'm just in charge of me. All I have to do is show up, admit the nature of my wrong, ask what I can do to make it right. The rest is his deal. None of my business. And that's where I learned that from. Like, this becomes a template for how I'm going to live my life, is how I'm going through these 12 steps. You know, because that becomes a tool now that I can use for, like, every situation in my life. And scary stuff is, you know, the certain trials and low spots ahead that Bill and Bob warned us are going to happen. I start getting a lot of tools in the ninth step, which is why we get those awesome promises. And then in 10, 4 through 9 all the time, the key word is continued. You know, remember I said that these are all action words that lead off these steps. So made is searching, made is an action, admitted, we're entirely ready, which is like past tense, but it's still an action word, humbly asked, made a list, made direct amends, and then continued is that key word of the 10th step. I've heard people say that it's a maintenance step, not on board with that one. It wasn't that way for me. I'm going to continue. And how am I going to continue? I'm going to enter the world of the Spirit, tells me. I get all those amazing promises. I'm going to continue to seek in 11. So 10 gets me ready for 11, and I continue to seek. And sought is another action. I sought through prayer and meditation, and I start doing that in my own life. And my sponsor tells me I'm going to go back to college. So I go back to college, and I'm scared to death of everything. But I go back to my fourth step where it says that God enables me to match calamity with serenity if I surrender to him and do this deal and try to help his kids. And that's that guiding promise throughout my whole sobriety, seriously. And it's always worked for me, and it's a wonderful experience. And then in 12... it's telling me I had a spiritual awakening already, because it says having had a spiritual awakening, like, that might have already happened before I get to 12, but I've had sponsees where it doesn't happen until after they start taking someone through the steps. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. It's all good. But having had a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps, and then I try to carry the message. It doesn't say I do it perfectly. I'm just going to try to do this deal and to practice the principles in all my affairs. And how do I know I'm practicing the principles? When I'm loving, and when I'm forgiving, and when I'm patient, and when I'm kind, and when I'm selfless, those are the principles. Those are the principles. In six it says we're going to, you know, grow into the image and likeness of our Creator. That's what that is for me. Like, those are the things that my higher power is. So when I'm practicing those things, I'm closer to Him. When I'm not practicing those things, I'm closer to self. And that's just how simple it is for me. And so that's, like, been the deal for me. And it's been a really wild ride. I've had low spots in sobriety, and it hasn't been like all rainbows and sunshine, but there's nothing nearly as bad as the part where Bill says, no words can tell of the loneliness and despair I felt, and quicksand stretched all around me. I had met my match. I'd been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. I've never had that sort of a bottom in sobriety. Like, I've had a broken heart. I've had, you know, even recently, I've had a lot of uncertainty and craziness happening. But that's, you know, that pain is a wake-up call. That's a wake-up call for me. And I just want to say about service, you know, I hated doing service when I got here. I won't say hate. Hate's a strong word. But I was, like, super selfish when I got here. And I didn't think I had anything to give. And I was really afraid to, like, even greet people. And what service has done for me is it's changed my heart. Like, it's just given me so much. Like, I can never pay it back. And, you know, I'm supposed to be dead. You know, a lot of us in this room probably can relate to that. And the fact that, like, we're not, and we're here, and we're sober, on a Thursday night in sunny South Florida in Fort Lauderdale is a miracle, you know, given our disease and people dying every moment. Like, the time that we've sat in this meeting, there's probably been at least 10 overdoses, like, just in our area, which are the statistics, and it's frightening. And service, what service does for me is I'll have some crazy problem going on that I have no control over, and I suspend that belief that I'm going to fix it, and I ask God to help me help somebody else, and he always puts someone else in my path that I can help. Usually when really everything is crashing down on me, I'll get, like, 5 new sponsees, and I'm like, really? Like, I don't have time to sponsor all these people right now. But by saying yes to service, my plate gets bigger, and that's the abundance, you know, and the joy of life we really have. And Dr. Bob says to Bill, you have to sponsor somebody else or you're going to die. Like, that's some of the last words that he utters to Bill on his deathbed. I get that, you know, and service for me is, it's key. You don't have to wait till the 12th step to do it. If you have 2 days sober, you can help somebody with 30 seconds or a day, because we've recovered. You know, I don't have a hopeless state of mind and body anymore where alcohol is concerned. I can go anywhere on God's green earth and not have that desire come back. And that's a gift. That's a miracle. And living with that peace, with that serenity, and getting to know a higher power and having a, you know, an actual relationship with him, not just a belief, but a, you know, how am I communicating with this power? Am I spending enough time with this power? You know, what does that look like? What does my God life look like? Having that is huge. It's a much bigger game than not drinking. So I think that's all I have. I want to thank the group for having me, though. This was really special. Thank you.
Let me thank Allie one more time. Now we're going to have Stephanie come up and do the secretary's report.
Hi, my name is Stephanie, and I'm your recovered alcoholic secretary. In keeping with the seventh tradition, which states that every group shall be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions, the baskets are now going around. I have asked Shelley to read the recovered statement. We read this notice to explain why many people in this group identify as recovered rather than recovering and what it exactly means to be a recovered alcoholic.
Hi, everyone. My name is Shelley. I'm a recovered alcoholic.
Hi, Shelley.
Recovered. We are not cured of alcoholism. Recovered, but not cured. That presents a conflict to some alcoholics. If we were cured, we would be able to drink responsibly. No, we are not cured. The allergic reaction to alcohol will remain with us for a lifetime. But we have been restored to sanity. That was the problem. The main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. We are now sane where alcohol is concerned. Consequently, we have recovered.
...1940-style Big Book sponsorship. From forward to the second edition, Alcoholics Anonymous, of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, 50% got sober at once and remained that way. 25% sobered up after some relapses, and among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. What we've seen, felt, come to believe, and experience is that God has not changed over time, and neither should the sacred approach back to his loving arms. The statistics above suggest a 75% success rate. May I please see a show of hands of recovered alcoholics? And is there anyone in need of a sponsor? Please raise your hand. Please stand up, sir. Are you in need of a sponsor? Oh, okay. all right. All right, looks like everyone's good. So please join us Monday nights for the Big Book Study meeting where the Big Book comes alive. Fellowship is at 6:30, and the Big Book Study starts at 7:15. We have CDs, mugs, large print Big Books, the Little Red Book, and Big Book Dictionaries for sale in the back. We meet every Thursday starting promptly at 7:15, and we ask that you be courteous and ready to begin at the sound of the bells. See you next week.
We have tonight's session and all the past speaker podcasts online for free at alcoholicsandgod.org if you'd like to check them out. I'd like to invite everybody back for our Monday night big book study up on the third floor here. And those who wish to thank the speaker, please line up down the center aisle. And if you're going to smoke after the meeting, when you go out the front doors, you're going to want to take a left and go all the way to the corner of the building. The Boy Scouts have their meeting here tonight, too, as well, so we don't want to be, you know, mingling with them. If you could, that'd be great. And we're going to close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father. See you next Monday.
Just can't get it right. Zan, oh, when you're smiling, when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you, baby, baby. Yes, when you're laughing. When you're laughing, yes, the sun comes shining through. But when you're crying, you bring on the rain. Stop your sighing, baby, and be happy again. Yes, and keep on smiling. Keep on smiling, baby. And I hope. Thank you.
boom, 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 boom.